Mics up, please. Okay, I think our microphones are live, and we are ready to start this study session. I would like to call this study session to order for Monday, April 16, 2018. It is now 12:04 p.m., just past noon. Our first item on the study session agenda is actually the Jeffco Online Enrollment Project. We begin our study session today on the presentation that was postponed on April 9. Jeffco's online enrollment project, which will include information as to why it's happening, what work is being done, and expected impacts and timing. Board members will have the opportunity to ask questions and engage in dialogue about project plans, scope of the project, project timing, policy implications, and other relevant topics. You may remember the discussion at the November 16th Board of Ed meeting regarding a variety of challenges Jeffco currently faces with regard to multiple application and enrollment processes, the vast majority of which are paper-based. Board members concluded that solutions should be identified and implementation considered. Since that time, Superintendent Dr. Glass has facilitated numerous conversations with a diverse group of stakeholders and summoned together a steering committee comprised of cross-functional district leaders to spearhead this work. Steering committee members have identified a set of solutions to implement in the 2018-19 school year and have contracted with an enrollment consultant to lead the initiative. Dr. Glass, anything to add to that introduction of this study session topic?
Yes, thank you. A couple of things. First of all, thank you to the board for coming together on for this special meeting. I know that it's outside of a regular cycle, but I really appreciate you guys being here. We've got a couple of important things to cover with you, and we're grateful that you had the time and took the time. I think specifically to this issue, we operate in an environment where school choice and competition exists, and it is not receding. It's probably only going to accelerate. And so this is a mechanism by which we can market and make the public available of the variety of quality and diverse programs that we have in our schools. There's a term in marketing that relates to how difficult it is to buy something called friction. And certainly education is not a commodity, it's a public good. But when it comes to enrolling in our schools, we want to make that process as frictionless as possible. We want to make it really easy to get enrolled in our schools, find out the quality programs and programming that we have available, and connect our families and kids to that. So that's the impetus or rationale behind much of this work. We have secured some philanthropic funding to help accelerate that and support it that Mr. Hsu and the team will be talking about with you as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Glass. And with that, welcome, Mr. Hsu. We'll let you introduce your team and begin the presentation.
Thank you. So we'll just go around and introduce the steering committee, and then we'll bring it back to me, and we'll kick it off.
Maybe it's still, oh, yeah. I'm Shannon Fitzgerald. I am the said enrollment consultant.
I'm Tim Matlick. I'm the achievement director that works with charter schools.
Belker, executive director of student data privacy and reporting.
Sherry Fast. I'm with the early learning department.
Kristen Harkness, assistant director of special education.
Diana Wilson, chief communications officer.
Hello, everyone. Christopher Hsu, Chief of School Secondary. So just to kick this off, just know the conversation, the work that we've been engaged in for 3 months has been around equity and access for students, and that has really been our driving force. We're also looking at creating a system that will allow for more information to supply the board, information to give to schools around resource allocation. So those have been the driving forces. We also have partnerships with the Rose Foundation. We've been working with them already. They're interested in working with us around these issues around equity and access, and they're looking to fund us and we're really excited about that. They also have brought in partners, and that would be the Gates Rubber family as well. So we also have some community resources involved, which will help with our funding mechanism. So we'll turn it over to Shannon Fitzgerald and take it away.
Great. Thank you very much for having me. So what I first want to say is when Jeremy and Christopher and the team were kind of filling me in on all the great things, they told me all the things we need to focus on and whatnot, but I wanted to make sure that I was very thorough with why it was we were thinking this work was important. And so what I did is I took a look at the video from the November 16th board meeting. And I have to say, as somebody who does this for a living, I was certainly pleased to see that there was, on that date, a pretty shared agreement around, the need for equity. Three things really stood out from that meeting. The need for equity and access for all students. I heard a lot about that during that meeting, which was awesome. Secondly, I heard a lot about the need for a mechanism by which we can share more about the different things that are happening and programs that are going on within schools at Jeffco. And then the last thing that I heard a number of times was this notion around you all needing more data to make better decisions as a system. So all of those things were really great takeaways, and I have to say again, as I do this for a living, that's great to hear. As a parent, though, from this district, I was very relieved to hear this because, you know, myself and my circle, my network, we've experienced these things firsthand. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and talk you through these slides. What we'd like to do, there's only six slides. It's a pretty brief presentation. What we'd like to do is walk you through sort of an update around this project and what's really happening, and then we'll open it up for questions and dialogue, if that works. Great. Towards the computer and turn on. Computer's back here. Something happened. I know, I'm just going to. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, so we already went around with a quick round of introductions, but want to again focus on sort of this is the steering committee, these folks around the table. And essentially, the work of this committee, we meet once a week, and what I've asked them to do is help clear the path for me for these things to actually make them happen. In addition to that, we have some various subject matter experts that are part of the core work team, and I'm kind of describing them as the doers, right? We're going to get this work done. And, of course, this is going to be very cross-functional. We need lots of folks. We need the special education voice at the table. We need people at the table from the communications team, obviously from the IT team. I'm going to be leading that group, and we're going to be actually getting these things done with the guidance and governance of the steering committee. Who. Let's talk for a minute about the what and what specifically we are doing as an outcome of that discussion that was had on November 16th. And the way I'm kind of parsing this out is there's really four big pieces to it. The first piece is that we will be moving our current paper enrollment and application system to a fully online application system. We are targeting 100% participation from all Jeffco schools. And we'll talk a minute about what exactly this will get us, but that's kind of thing number one. The second thing we are aiming to implement here is an online search tool that parents can use to easily access information about Jeffco schools. We've had some great visioning sessions with Diana and her team around what this would look like, what that flow would look like, what are the different search criteria we want to be able to offer to families. And so, if you're looking for an arts program for a second grader in the south part of Jeffco, how would you come to find that type of thing? So we'll talk a little bit more about that. The third thing is we also want to implement a more systematic way by which families proclaim, if you will, that they are going to they plan to return to the school that they're currently attending. Currently, this happens in a somewhat haphazard way across the district. Some schools ask their families if they're coming back, other schools don't, and then oftentimes they end up being surprised in August when kids they thought were coming back really end up not coming back. And so we want to put a little bit more rigor around that process to make sure that schools have that information for them. And then the last thing is something that currently happens regardless of if we're doing a larger initiative like this or not. But the other thing we want to do is take a look at our current enrollment policies and make sure that they fit and that they're practical with what it is that we're looking to change. All of these things said, I really want to call your attention to the bottom part, though, that these new processes and practices are really in the spirit of providing transparency and equity for every single family who resides in Jeffco. And that's regardless of if they're choosing to attend their neighborhood school, which most of them do, or if that's that they're, you know, choosing to attend another neighborhood school or an option school or a charter school. So let's talk for a minute about the why. And again, I know you all discussed this pretty thoroughly back in November. But what we want to do is we want to make this process more parent-friendly. That's one of the primary, obstacles, if you will, when we think about equity and who's able to be successful in this system of all of these different school choices. Additionally, we want to improve consistency between schools. So again, today, we have nobody in the district who owns enrollment. There is zero FTE right now who's an enrollment manager or an enrollment director or anything. And so again, schools are sort of left to their own devices to put out their own applications, run their own lotteries, figure out, you know, who should I offer the seat to next, the kid who's number one on the wait list or the kid who's number 10 on the wait list. And there's really very little to no oversight over that. So we definitely want to improve on that consistency piece. In addition to the consistency, what goes along with that is the transparency piece, right? Today, there is nobody in the district who can explain why or how a certain student either did or didn't get into the school of his or her choosing, right? Again, it's all very school-based, and there's very little transparency around that, and so we can't answer most of those questions. We want to make sure that we are also enabling school leaders to have a sense of confirm what their numbers are much, much earlier in the process. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, this whole roster shuffle that happens inevitably in August is really hard for schools, right? Perhaps they haven't staffed appropriately enough, perhaps they don't have enough materials, and it can go one of two ways. It can either be much bigger than what they anticipated, or in many cases, it's much smaller, and especially with today's SPB environment, they are having to scramble to make some really tough decisions. We want to minimize that type of August shuffle as much as humanly possible. And with this system, we feel like we're going to be able to give them sort of that roster stability much earlier in the process, meaning like in the March-April timeframe right now versus, the first week of school. And then lastly, what we really want to do as well is we really want to empower you all with some good data and some good analytics. So as you think about things, what was also presented that night on November 16th was the idea about the art school. And I think what I heard from all of you is, well, that sounds like a great idea, and maybe we're interested in it, maybe we're not. We're not really sure. But there was no data for you to look at to say, we know with confidence that there are, 27% of our ninth graders are seeking an arts program. There was just nothing like that. And so what you do have today is you have a lot of data around where are kids going and where are they landing. What you absolutely have no data around is the why are they doing that? Why are they choosing what they're choosing? And what other options are there out there that we don't know about that they are looking to enroll in? Some other benefits that we've talked about that might not fall right in line with what that discussion sounded like in November was the opportunity to capture more pre-kindergarten students. And so right now, again, as we think about that August roster shuffle, it's also the August kindergarten surprises, right? We have lots of families who don't show up until, the first day of school, which of course is okay, and of course we will serve those kids, but it's so much better if we can get those kids engaged a few months earlier so that, again, we know what those kindergarten numbers are coming in. And then lastly, and this is a really big and important one, we have, subsets of students, and whether those be students with gifted and talented needs, whether those be students with IEP needs, 504 plans, things of that, we have these special students who need these extra services, and what we really would like to do is be able to align their processes with understanding what those services are that they need with what their school options are and allow them to go through, allow them to have the same choices that their general education peers have. And today, the timing on those processes aren't quite aligned in a way that really allow us to do that in a good way. So that was all about kind of the common application tool. So let's talk a minute about the why for a school finder. What we want to be able to do, and again, this is a bit of a no-brainer, but we want to be able to provide one place where a parent who lives in Jeffco, or even a parent who doesn't live in Jeffco, can go to say, you know, what are the school options and offerings that Jeffco has to offer. You know, we are envisioning something that's going to be super intuitive, that will walk a parent through, you know, a parent of any literacy level, walk a parent through exactly what it is that we have to offer. We want a tool that will fully inform them of their neighborhood school offerings and what that is for them, and so that, you know, again, if they've heard something about their neighborhood school, they are presented with the real data and the real information for them, and whether that be pictures or a paragraph about the school culture or, you know, whatever that might be, we want to make sure they have that. We also want to allow them to compare and contrast different schools. So we're envisioning sort of a side-by-side. If you ever go on Amazon and you compare products, sort of a side-by-side comparison so that you can compare apples to apples. And then lastly, our schools today have very limited resources, meaning to market their schools in a very consistent way. So there is no one place, right? I think Diana and her team have done a wonderful job with equipping them with a toolkit, I think that was this past fall, that really helps them as far as how to market and how to put out a good website. But again, if I don't know what I'm looking for as a parent, I'm not gonna know to go to your school's website. I need a place where I'm able to actually go and find things that I may not even know exist. Just to quickly update you on what we've already done here. So I'm on board. I've been here for about 3 weeks now. Everything's going very well. We have a really comprehensive project plan that has been created. We have developed a pretty comprehensive budget. We've had initial and even not so initial conversations to really map out what we want these processes to look like. We've started to develop the technical requirements around what our systems should look like. We are in the beginning stages of putting together the RFP for the technical solutions. And I know Dr. Glass and Mr. Hsu also referenced this, but I think this speaks very highly to this work and maybe to the perception of what's happening here. But the Rose Foundation has, we are very optimistic. We've gotten some great signals that they will be, they are very interested in funding a significant portion of this kickoff work, which I think is really a very, very positive sign. In addition to that, they have also referred us over to the Gates Family Foundation, with whom we have a meeting set coming up here in the very near future, and they have also signaled a very high level of interest in getting involved in this work. So we're feeling great about that. We've also done some initial benchmarking, and the team actually did this prior to my arrival with both Eagle County, for obvious reasons, and also DPS, as they're right next door. In addition to that, I've worked with numerous dozens of cities and counties throughout the United States, and so I have a lot of information that I've shared with these guys around sort of comparing similar districts and what they want to do and how they've staffed this and how they've resourced it. And then, of course, we're already kind of underway in executing on our plan with looking at the policies. What's happening next? So this is a very, very 30,000-foot view of our project plan. Between now and the middle of summer, we're going to be kicking off that RFP process, hopefully identifying the vendor that will be able to provide these technological solutions for us. We're going to be designing what the system looks like and documenting all of that. We will be gathering all of the schools' information so that when we have this online school finder, we have a very nice comparison, again, apples to apples. We have to talk to every school to get what are their hours of operation, what's their before school situation look like, what's after school look like, do they offer lacrosse or swimming, or do they have a STEM program? So we're going to be talking and gathering that information from all of our schools so that our school finder is very robust and very accurate. And then also we'll be working with Tim and the charter schools to make sure that they understand what this initiative is about. As I mentioned earlier, we are targeting 100% school participation, but as you probably also know, the charters are under no legal obligation to participate. We feel as though it would be very important for them to, because they are part of the Jeffco family, to be not only offered on the School Finder tool, but also to adhere to this common application process that we've described. And then this fall, what you'll see happening, or what you might hear about happening, is that the development will be underway for the tools. We'll be testing the systems. We will be engaging with school staff to tell them about this new system and what that might mean for them, how they can be communicating to parents with it, or about it, pardon me. And we will be doing some outreach or begin doing our outreach to parents in the community. And then come this winter, what you'll see is a little bit of last-minute testing, and everything will be kind of teed up to go live. We are planning to go live, or we would like to go live in December with our School Finder tool, and then in January with our online application, so that all of this is in place. The hopes is that all of this is in place then for our enrollment season for the 19-20 school year. With that, I will open it up for questions.
I'm going to start with kind of a very board member-y question. What are the current policy conversations or implications that you all are already talking about? What kind of changes can we expect you all to say, this is better practice, and help me understand why?
Well, when you're talking about policy, we do have a district choice enrollment policy, and we've got 8 very specific categories around those. So as with all of our work, we'd be engaging with that, starting with this team and bringing in other stakeholders to talk about whether there be any tweaks and changes to that choice enrollment policy. But we're not seeing really many changes to that. We don't anticipate many changes to that. What this is about, it's not even about choice enrollment. This is about enrollment in general in Jefferson County. So there's a kind of a longer answer to your question, but we don't anticipate many changes taking place at that district choice enrollment policy, because this is really around enrollment in general here in Jefferson County and having access and 100% participation for all of our parents and schools in it.
So then the next question I have is addressing this value of equity. We have about 1 in 3 families choosing choice enrollment as their path of enrollment and 2/3 who aren't. This may create some oversight in how well our schools fulfilling the policy that exists, but it doesn't necessarily address those family level barriers, things like that we've heard, like transportation or a family's capacity to make choices other than their neighborhood school. Can you talk to me how then the district envisions kind of its partnership to ensure that this isn't a tool that is a convenience for families who can already activate a level of convenience that other families can't?
Can I start with that one? Yeah, so I think what you said is spot on. This is not a silver bullet, right? And so, you know, when we talk about the scope of what we're looking at here, unfortunately, this year, in any case, we are not looking at transportation. We are not looking at, you know, some of those bigger barriers to choice. Having said that, what I will also say is that any district cannot get to that point to tackle those types of barriers until you have a platform in place that at least has the communication and outreach and the application process the same for everybody, right? So the way I look at this work is that it's sort of foundation building, because unless you have this stuff, you're not going to be able to solve those other things that are sort of higher on the needs.
Sure, thank you. And I recognize that we have a district choice enrollment policy. We also have a policy around equal educational opportunities. So I think it's going to be really important to figure out that we can ensure that is in place for all students at all schools, which kind of leads me to what I think will be my last question, which is when it comes to navigating both this communication tool for families, as well as the sustainability of the kinds of offerings that are highlighted there. You know, as board members and certainly sometimes as parents, we've experienced what it's like for tough trade-offs and losses when it comes to budget to put at risk programmings that families are relying on. My hope is this will give us insight to what families want, and we can know and preserve that and maybe broaden access to it to all schools. But I also wonder then, what is the expectation for how the district will envision its kind of partnership with an enrollment process that allows or supports schools to grow in demand programs to assure families of some level of sustainability, knowing that if a family chooses a school, neighborhood option charter within their boundary or not, that they're if they're choosing for certain offerings, how stable can we assure them that those offerings are? Because I think we've seen those school communities this year, last year, in budget conversations are thinking about those trade-offs, and none of them are comfortable. We're not in a situation of plenty or abundance in a lot of cases. So what does it look like for school staff to be assured that it's not just kind of a PR tool? It really is, there's some oversight regarding what a school can claim to offer and how. How does that happen so that the district knows how to partner with growing programs in a school or assuring that it's not just, well, we call ourselves this. We want some consistency and reliability for families. And I think we also want some systems to support schools who feel like this is, they feel the risk in seeing choice and competition surfaced in a way that may not benefit them.
So let's just talk about access a little bit, because one of the points you had brought up, right now it's paper. And if for families who are able to use the paper system to its best, they have transportation of their own. They are really good at getting online and researching schools. There's not a common tool to do that, but getting on. And then they have to have the time during the day to move around to schools and deliver these papers. So already we have an inequity going on. We don't have a system where any parent can get on, and they don't need all these different pieces I just talked about in order to research schools and then to put in their child's name in a school of choice that they want outside of their neighborhood school. So that's that whole equity and access part right there. You've also talked about the information part, and Diana's team has done a great job this year already putting together a packet and helping schools move towards a better online presence with their website. And this tool, what it would do, it would systematize the entire system here in Jeffco, where a parent would get on, there would be a framework that all schools could use to say, these are the programs we're going to highlight. The other point you talked about, and I was thinking about one school in particular, where, getting back to Shannon's point, it would stabilize the information and the enrollment for the principal for them to say, now I know how many kids are coming to my school. And then because of the questions we can embed in this program that the board, you could create, the principals could create, the steering committee could create, it would inform that school to say, this many people are applying because they're interested in these programs. For example, the PAW program at Pomona. And Andy Geis is looking for more information around that. So he could be embedding some questions. You could be embedding some questions around that. So we would know, are there families who would love to go to Pomona? But once again, are there barriers in place for them getting there? If it's a family that wants to get into the PAW program, which is the Pomona Arts and Humanities program, but they live in the South, is there a barrier? So if their child gets accepted, hooray, but then they find out we don't have busing to get them there, they can't carpool to get there. Those would be some questions we could embed to inform us and you folks as the board, what resources should we be putting in that direction to create access for those families? Once again, it does touch those words we kicked off this meeting with. It provides more information around the equity, the access, for families, so we can figure out what is we need to be doing in Jefferson County to really create a system where families could get to the programs that would really benefit their child. And then if there are programs out there that everyone's asking for, but we don't have them, where could we allocate resources and where could we possibly put these programs that could benefit all of our families?
Other questions, colleagues?
As far as the equity piece, there are a lot of different ways we're thinking this might address equity. So right now when I'm thinking about my experience choice enrolling in two different schools, I had to take in a birth certificate. I'm not sure I would ever do that online. So I think there will still be transportation, right? If that's one of the things you have to do. Like, it kind of shocked me that you had to do that in the first place. You know, is that a must?
There are still documents you have to take in once you are enrolled, and those can either happen at the school that you're enrolling into or in your neighborhood school, depending on how it's configured here. So there's still validation of certain information that the schools will need to collect. The online enrollment system is merely a way to sort of capture the beginnings of that, and then as students show up at school, they'll need to bring in documentation.
Yeah, but there should be no documentation required pre-assignment to the school.
Well, there was.
So that speaks to the consistency.
Right. Right. Yeah.
Right.
No. Okay. And then my question, and I think I brought it up last time we spoke about this in the fall, is equity as far as, I think it's probably a lot easier for most populations to actually fill out the paperwork right now and bring it in. because of obstacles of not having access to proper modes of technology. And I'm wondering, and I'm sure you know that, and I'm wondering what the plan of action is so that we can feel comfortable that it is accessible for everybody.
Yeah. No, that's a very, very legitimate concern. What we have found is that that absolutely is the case if you build a system that is only available via laptop or desktop. What we are planning to do is create a mobile app that also would be smartphone enabled, and so you would be able to do it that way. In addition, and we haven't fully fleshed this out yet, but we understand that this is going to be a need in specific areas of the district. So what we've also talked about doing is creating kiosks in the front of school offices and in that. What I will tell you about this, though, too, is I have recently worked with a district in California that has about an 80% FRL rate, and this was exactly their concern. So what we ended up doing was offering an online version as well as a paper version, and we talked to our schools about supporting the online version because of accuracy reasons, because it's just easier. It's, you know, there's so many benefits. We had no paper applications turned in, and I know it's hard to get your head around that, but it's this is something that in a district like Jeffco, we can absolutely go online, and we will make sure that families of lower income who don't have access, whether it be to smartphones or to internet, that they will have an opportunity to, there will be workarounds that we will offer. So I feel really confident about that, and I might not have had that same answer 5 years ago, but given what the apps can look like now, I think we should be in really good shape.
Okay, I would look forward to hearing more about that as we
definitely
possibly progress in utilizing the system. Another, when you compare, I'm wondering if you've spoken with end users in school districts that have used this to see what their concerns are, because I know a lot of parents who have concerns about this process in Denver, and they have a lot of pretty valid concerns. And I would like to know what kind of research you have done so we can, if and when we get to the point where we are adopting this and doing this, we can make sure our end users don't feel that way, and so it'll be better.
So I myself, do you want to take that one or?
Is this on? Okay. You know, I want to walk you through real quick kind of what we're thinking and why we're thinking that. So we know most of our kids that are coming to school next year are going to their same school, right? So we know that. Then we know we have some kids that are changing schools either because they're kindergartners, they're going to middle school, they're going to high school. That's our next biggest group. And then our smallest group actually are people who choose, okay? We need to design our system to make it as easy as possible for our biggest users, and then, you know, you dig deeper the more you're making selections. So let's say I have a second grade kid and it's January and I need to do online enrollment. I should be able to go on, put in my address, say I'm going to my neighborhood school and be done because I know that's what I'm going to do. Let's say I have a fifth grader that's going to middle school next year. I should be able to go on, see what my homeschools are. Yes, I'm going to my homeschool, then I'm done. Or I kind of want to look around. You pick another button. It shows you some choices. What are you looking for? You check, I'm interested in after school sports and this and this, and then it kicks up what's closest to you, compares it to your home neighborhood school, and you see, okay, these are all the things, this is how far they are for me, and then you make a decision on whether, okay, I'm still going to my neighborhood school and I'm done, or I want to apply for these three schools and see what happens, all right? So having good descriptions of our schools, making it easy for the people who our most frequent users, so trying to design it to what we already do, because we're not trying to change our enrollment policies, right? What we're trying to do is give people a resource of, hey, this is where, like right now, I was giving a couple of board members an example the other day. I work here, and if somebody said, how many of our schools offer STEM? I'm like, I don't know. I'd have to go to every single website or talk to all the principals and have them raise their hand in a room because we don't have it one place. Whereas if you had an online tool like this and I checked STEM, it would give me a list. Hey, here's all the schools. This is a STEM school. This offers a STEM program for the entire school. This offers STEM for X amount of kids. You know, you would know. So we can't compare ourselves to other schools, but I got to be honest with you. She sent me three links of, hey, here's how other places have done it, which are all vastly different from each other, which I found fascinating, but also made it very clear to me that we need to customize this for Jeffco. What do we do here, and what do we need here to make it what our parents need? and what our schools need, to be blunt, you know, because it really would be helpful to them to be able to plan ahead and to be able to program ahead. What are our demands? What did people search for the most? You know, I personally believe we should have a preschool at every single elementary school, but is there really a demand for that? Hopefully we'll find out if we implement a tool like this.
Thank you. And what I would really like to learn is what we've learned from other districts implementing the system, and how, you know, because any new thing that offers systems efficiencies also offers unintended consequences if we don't get ahead of, you know, if we don't learn from other people. So I would love to hear sometime, maybe in a weekly update, what we've learned from Denver's system or any other systems, and how we're going to make sure any negative unintended consequences aren't realized in Jeffco.
One of the advantages of Jeffco doing this now is that you're not at the bleeding edge of this anymore. Like a lot of other districts have already done this and made a lot of errors. And we can avoid those because we can study their implementation experiences and adapt to those. And we have a consultant here who's worked with several different districts in different contexts. So we'll be using best practices from all those implementations.
So I would ask my colleagues, do you think that would be beneficial information for us to hear what we've learned from other districts and possibly get that in a weekly update? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
A general question, then I have just two assumptions that I just want to vet through you to make sure that I'm thinking about this the correct way without going into the weeds too much. My first question has to do with the how does the system better support our general education families that have children with additional special needs? Putting aside ALPs, ILPs, and 504s, which are really run by teachers in all buildings, I can't imagine how the system would somehow vet that out, but really more focusing particular on IEPs as that relates to reallocation of resources, which is a huge challenge for our buildings and our students. GT, understanding there's a center program piece of that, and then our general ed GT students, and Kristen, I'm looking at you to help me understand that navigation piece a little bit and how that would enhance those opportunities.
Great questions. So right now we're in the very beginning of looking at this, and so the very first piece that we've done was special education. Can you hear me? I'm not on. I am. Oh. Okay, so the first thing that we have done is we've gone to our special education leadership and just gathered ideas. If this system was magic, the question that I asked last week was, if the system was magic, what would it be able to do for our students with IEPs? And so we gathered that feedback. Shannon and I are going to sit down with that feedback. It's sitting on my desk for you. And to say, how can we do this better? As you know, we have several constraints. We have several different things that we have to look at. And right now, when we were talking and Diana was saying we have to really customize the system for Jeffco, one of the highlights is to customize it for our students with IEPs, for our students with special education needs. I really can't give details right now, but it is on the forefront of what we'd like to do, and we would really like this system to be magical and assist us with those processes. Another magic that I would like to see is being able to determine much earlier for our families where our programs are going to be located and then where students can access those programs. So absolutely, it's in the forefront. Details forthcoming.
Okay, and I do appreciate that. And that's why I was kind of assuming you're going down that pathway of staying within your Arctic area school. I'm hearing that this online enrollment is for everyone. So if you have an IEP, that information is critically important as early as possible to all schools. If you are then thinking of choicing, that creates a whole other labyrinth of challenges in terms of allocation of resources. I'm just going to throw a plug in there that it would be really great if we could do a better job of not reallocating our resources and those being our IEP teachers all the time, because that's really hurtful to our student base, to our building base, and I think we could be doing a better job with that. And I'm hoping that there's something we can build into the system that would allow buildings to be planning ahead for that, and that would be probably earlier notification of intent to stay in a school or transfer. I know that seems like a burden, but I think that that would actually allow us to do some better planning and not make it feel that people are overburdened, either really at the resource level in the buildings or as families trying to navigate those needs. Understanding the additional challenges, every single IEP is different, and we're counting bodies in a building, not resources and needs of a staff, and recognizing the federal law and things that nothing we can do about. But and I know that's long-winded, but I hear that a lot in our buildings, and I know it's really challenging. So and recognizing that's 10% of our population, I think, I don't really know, that it doesn't seem that, but in terms of resources and in terms of time, it's a significant challenge on our buildings. So I would like to see us, I personally would love to hear some additional feedback on that piece of it. In terms of GT, I recognize that perhaps some of these programming pieces and how we fine-tune and market that in terms of staffing with people with GT certificates in buildings to better educate our populations of staff that are in these buildings, to highlight that as well, not just focused on center programs, that a significant portion of our GT students are served outside of center programs, and it's a population that I think we also need to make sure we're paying attention to in terms of how we market this process. For me to move forward and really thinking about it, I think it could do so much more than comparing this building to that building, that if we really want to educate our populations and increase opportunities for our students, it's looking a little bit deeper. I don't know how to do that. I don't have the technology end. These are, again, magic pill. But those were my thought process in going through this. I've always choiced into my neighborhood schools. I take the time to go to the schools, ask those questions. But I'm that kind of a person. But it would be nice to also be able to see and look and answer other questions that are on there. But those are things that I've never really seen answered. And it's a challenge, particularly when you're reallocating resources in a building.
So I wanted to throw in here that that's one of the biggest reasons to do this, because you should be able to tell. After people enroll, most of our kids are returning, right? So we are able to look at their records right away and see, are they IEP, are they GET, are they whatever? So our school leaders should have access to all that data for the majority of their students ahead of time so that they can plan ahead.
That's not really true with IEPs because of HIPAA. So that's not really true. So you don't have that information, which can be significantly challenging for buildings. So that's not true. It's not.
It's not in campus, Christopher, that kind of information? Oh. Sorry.
Yes and no is the best answer to that. Yeah, is accurate. So it is. Individual needs of students is protected. So
similarly, we have there are very few people who are able to access who are our free and reduced lunch qualifying families. That's done for a reason. We do protect their privacy because we want to meet their needs, but we do that in a context of really making sure that we don't create opportunities for assumptions. So, the district is going to have to be really smart in how it partners to ensure that this is a way to grow opportunities and serve students' diverse needs, rather than introducing new trade-offs.
So let me speak for a minute to what principals know and do not know. Our current choice enrollment policy includes some guidelines that say in the application process, parents have to indicate if students have additional special needs. The reason that they indicate this is twofold. One, that a principal is responsible for managing the caseload for their learning specialists and other specialists in a building. And what they don't want to do is take on additional students who have additional needs without the resource to really support them efficiently and effectively. In the old system, what we used to do is do that kind of blind without knowing that information. Principals would take as many students as they felt they needed to match the staffing that they needed to do at about $5,000 per kid in SBB, later find out that students might have special needs and that there might be too many students on a learning specialist caseload, then call the family back and say, ooh, sorry, we said yes to you and you sent the letter back to us that said you wanted the spot, but now I have to tell you I need to put a hold on that temporarily until I'm sure I have additional space, which is just heart-wrenching for students and families because they get the t-shirt, they put the acceptance letter on the refrigerator, get all excited, and then they get the call that says, oh, we want you to come, but we don't have the space quite yet. So instead now we ask up front, it's right in that policy, so that principals can monitor those numbers and welcome as many students as they can. According to the state law, you are allowed to limit based on program type, and special education is considered a program within the broader school. Is that helpful?
It is. I think the challenge there is it looks like a pre-screening. It looks like you are being treated as a separate class from general education students. It can be perceived both ways. I appreciate that both ways. I'm just optimistic, again, with our magic pill, that is families feel that they are having equitable and equal opportunities and choice and not using that category to pre-select. I'll use the IB program as the same way. That there are sometimes these unique learning needs can be perceived as a barrier, but understanding it's both ways. I see it both ways. I do, just in terms of how we present it, I would hope that it's perceived that way. But it can be challenging. Again, inconsistencies within buildings. Hopefully we can also work towards that perception that is uniform to match what you're saying.
Certainly. The challenge is if we don't have a way to monitor that along the way, second round choice enrollment goes through August 31st, and we would be moving teachers and speech language therapists all the way up to the beginning of school, which would be difficult on our employees as well.
Yes, you know what I'm talking about. So yes, and that is extremely challenging for populations and for schools and for families when you can't say, you know, whereas everyone else is saying, here's your math department, here's your English department, we're not really sure what we're doing here, it's challenging. So my two assumptions are that we aren't excluding the continued ability to market and promote within our schools. So if you're staying in your TIC area currently, you go to the PTA meeting, the library, they talk about your neighborhood schools. That would continue for our populations. This is an add-on to that to allow parents another opportunity to compare within and outside of.
That's correct.
And then the next assumption is that we will be doing some form of fairly intensive education for families on how to utilize this system, including those that are staying in their traditional system. What we've always known is you get this little card if you're coming back, or you check this little box, and you fill it out, and it goes somewhere. That I'm assuming that's all going away as well, which is lovely. But that education piece for families to make sure that we're bringing them along with this new process at the same time.
Yes, that's correct. And that's the kind of stuff that you will see happening starting this fall. Thanks.
So we're investing or contemplating investing in a program. That investment is intended to provide the equity. It's intended to provide the efficiencies. It's intended to provide us new data. And it's intended to push out information so that parents, families can make better decisions. But it's an investment, so we're putting upfront money and we're putting ongoing money in hopes of replacing an inefficient paper-based system. To be sure, the current paper-based system costs us, but those costs are diverse. They're spread out to each of the schools that manages that flow of paper for 3 months a year or something like that, right? So we're replacing that with a central system that's hopefully efficient, but it also is going to have ongoing costs. So I'm interested in what the ongoing costs of administering this system will be.
So there will be most of the, it's very front-end loaded, right? So to get this off the ground, we're going to have to purchase some technology to do it. We should expect there to be some ongoing licensing fees. And again, we don't even have an RFP out yet, so we don't know exactly what that will be. But certainly there will be ongoing technology costs. And in addition to that, there, I believe what's been built into the budget ask is a 2 FTE. And so that would be an ongoing cost as well. What I would say is what you're getting in return is not just an automated system, but what you're going to be getting in return is data to make better systemic, you know, decisions about where do you want to replicate programs, where do you want to, you know, minimize programs, that type of thing. It's going to be in so far as the ability for schools to market their programs appropriately and all the other things kind of that you saw that.
Yeah, I've recited the benefits already. I'm asking about what we think the costs will be. You've got two FTEs. If those are going to be a year around, the current system has a very intense activity during 3 months or ish, but then the remainder of the year it kind of goes dormant. And so I'm wondering what is the function of those two FTEs the remainder of the year.
Yep.
It sounds as though there are different software packages out there that have been designed to solve this problem. And so we don't know which we would be going with, so we don't know what the technical ongoing costs will be. Right? Mm-hmm. Jason was looking like you were grabbing the microphone.
Christopher. Yeah,
I'm
coordinate who's going to respond.
Yeah, I'm going to start up here, and then if some other people want to jump in. I just want to start by saying that in my experience in Jefferson County in this leadership position over the years, when we bring great programs online, we do not bring the people along line to manage it, to strategically plan for it, to align it in the system. What we tend to do is we say, this is a great program, we need this. And then people look around and figure out where it should land. And this is a system that we believe we should not be doing that. We should not be looking around and saying, Jeremy Fucker can handle this. We're looking for a system that we're going to stand up. It is going to thrive. It's going to continue. It's going to be aligned. There's going to be somebody that is going to be able to strategic plan for it, work with the members of the steering committee, work with our schools, take questions from the board, and really implement this with fidelity. And through conversations with Brett Miller, asking about what it is that this job would entail, and Brett could talk a little bit more about it if we wanted to. Shannon can also talk a little bit more about it. But we're bringing on a product that is going to have somebody who totally understands it and can work with the vendor. It can't just be, let's bring it online and hope that Brett can find two or three people that can kind of work together to figure it out. It's the same thing on the other side with the FDE, the director of online. We can once again bring it online, and some of the achievement directors will work with it. Jeremy will work with it. I'll work with it a little bit. But there's no systemic practice of this whatsoever. And what this ends up being is it's just more work on top of someone else's plate. And then that person needs to prioritize. So I can imagine Jeremy and I in his office next year. All right, so I'll handle this. You do this. But at expense of what? And then does the system really get implemented with fidelity in the way that it really could be implemented? And that's what we're looking for, is somebody who is going to take this system to people and run with this and make it as gold as it can possibly be. Instead of what we've done in the past, which is, here's that great system that everyone's excited about. Now who will take bits and pieces and parts of it to try to make this thing work?
We'll have customer service aspects of this too. So you'll have questions and unforeseen situations that you'll have to have somebody responding to those and developing answers or developing systems to accommodate those. So our recommendation in the budget is for the upfront costs. We're going to potentially have some philanthropic dollars that help us with that. But I would strongly recommend to the board, unless we're willing to make the investments for the staff to manage this, don't do it, because it will cause more problems.
Right, and I appreciate what you're saying, but I think you got the cart before the horse a little bit, and that is that we need to identify what the ongoing functions are and when they occur. You don't say, well, we know this is a big project, we therefore need two people, and we'll figure out what's going to land in each of their respective laps. That's not how you design a position, I don't think. So I'm interested in knowing, have we analyzed what the specific roles are and when those roles will occur? Your customer service example is a perfect example. I would guess that customer service aspect will hit primarily during 3 or 4 months when families are making these decisions and schools are trying to help families implement these decisions, whether it's through a kiosk or something. By the way, I really like that idea. So I want to design the tasks of a position before we go out there and just decide we're going to have two FTEs.
Right. I think we're, again, in the advantageous place of the other places. Other districts around the country have already done this, so we can look at their roles, and we've seen their sort of onboarding implementation process as well. So there's a number of elements around design, of the system, testing, beta testing, alignment of policies and that were paper and how does it work online, language translation issues. There's a bunch of upfront work that has to be done. So I would expect that these positions will be doing some of that and then transitioning over to more routine functions going forward. But maybe Shannon has some background too.
Yeah, I was going to say, again, I've worked with many, many districts. Jeffco has the unfortunate or fortunate distinction of the only district that I have worked with that is more than 5,000 people that doesn't already have an enrollment person or department. What I would expect to have, given your current processes and how enrollment currently works, I would expect to see a small department of 3 to 4 people who are putting together the paper application, who are monitoring enrollment number, you know, who are doing just the basic support work, which right now we have zero FTE. So, and again, I think there are different districts that do choice and enrollment with a totally different philosophy. And so, you know, I would never recommend to you need 20 people like what DPS has, because we have a different philosophy here, right? So that's overboard. But I would argue you definitely need more than zero. And the other thing that I would say about that is as you worry about kind of, you know, aren't they only going to be busy 3 months of the year, enrollment is an ongoing process. And so I would say the lowest activity level from an enrollment perspective is usually October, November, right? But in August, in July and August, you have families that are moving in brand new to the district. You have that August shuffle. And again, my hope is that we're going to minimize that tremendously, but that's happening, right? And then in September, you have kids that are, oh my gosh, this was a terrible move. I got to move schools. This person would be, or these people, this small team of two, need to be training the schools to make sure we are all singing off the same sheet of music. They're going to need to be, providing the analytics, that rich data that we're promising you to say, you know, we know you need this stuff. So there is a plethora of work. These people will not be bored. I promise. Right. Year round. I promise.
Well, and it's kind of cyclical. So like August, they'll be sending everybody information. Hey, this is where you enrolled. This is what you need to do. Da 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 da. September taking care of all the changes. When October rolls around, then to start to work with our schools. Okay. You need to start, when are your open houses? When are you going to have this? How are we going to tell people? Let's get this information out. So working with the schools to get their information all updated. Then January, February, March, maybe April, depending on when choice enrollment is, then you're actually managing the system. All the people that are enrolling, how they're balancing it out, pulling reports for people, supporting your school leaders that are trying to use the system. Then we'll have downtime again where they'll have to update for the next fall, so people who are just shopping for schools. And then in summer is going to be your system updates, as well as I'm personally hoping, yeah, we're going to roll out this system, but then we'll continually improve this system to answer different aspects of our organizational needs, so it's more one-stop shopping for our people. So that's the lay person. I don't know the IT person because I'm not an IT person, but it seems like it'd be really hard to me.
Well, actually, your answer there was a good illustration of why you need to design the roles first and then talk about people, because several of the responsibilities you just recited are not likely to exist in the same person. Part of it's marketing. Part of it is helping them organize their webpage, organize the open houses like those. Those are sort of marketing your school, being accessible sort of roles. Very different from an IT sort of person, and maybe quite different from the sort of person that's going to help our schools navigate the enrollment and staffing challenges that go along with that in the August shuffle. I don't want to push this too much because I know we're in early days, and I get that. But I want us to make sure that we're thinking about it in the right order. I also want to speak to the August shuffle because I really hope we can minimize that. I've had some schools in the last 2 years that have been really damaged by being surprised by 40 kids not showing up and they didn't necessarily budget for it. If we can get to a place where we have a system that minimizes that risk, then maybe it'll allow some of our schools to free up some money rather than being quite so defensive in their budgeting, because I know that also is a topic of conversation when we're talking about budgeting and we're holding $125,000 over here just in case I lose 60 kids. Well, if we can get closer, if we can minimize that August shuffle, then we can start using that money for the educating of children rather than holding it as a rainy day fund in case people don't show up in August. That's a big value to me.
Our hope is to make it the March shuffle, right? So there will be roster shuffle, right? In the way we're thinking of building this is that any student can get multiple offers to however many schools they want to apply to, but then there's going to be a time that we draw a line in the sand and we say, but you have to choose by March 15th or whatever the magic date is that we come up with. And by that point, they are on one and only one roster. And so again, there will still be a little bit of shuffle, but the idea is that you know it months in advance budgetary perspective and a staffing perspective versus knowing 2 weeks before school opens.
And we're not staffing in August.
Right.
So I want to elevate as a quick last thought on my part. I think the proof will be in the pudding. We have an opportunity to do something that's been in the works in Anita and Jeffco for a while. It's not a new conversation. Shannon, I recognize you from work that happened here 4 years ago. So I want to recognize that and say I'm glad that the district is saying this is work that we'd like to move forward on. I think the proof will be in the pudding in that there are some pieces of, say, quality control, I think was a phrase, Diana, you talked about, that it will be a dynamic process, and we should expect to hear families and students talk about the value that they find in it. And then I think we should absolutely expect to hear schools and school staff talk about the value they find in it. It should, in fact, create flexibility, solutions, information sooner, responsiveness. Right now, there are school staff that manage some of this. I know there are schools that have said, we have implemented a 2-day callback. If you hear from us, you gotta let us know within 48 hours if you're taking that slot so that we have the capacity to ensure you're not double counted, to ensure we don't lose you first day of school. It will matter to me that we're hearing from schools that the work that they seek to do for students is joyful, flexible, and supported in a new way.
Oh, just a quick additional information. One of the pieces that we've been looking at this year with our alternative education campuses, and I know you all were able to hear what Matt Walsh had to say last week, and one of the pieces is, I believe those numbers, they grow. Our considered option schools, they grow exponentially. I believe it was 3 to 4 times between August and March. And therefore, we do have rolling enrollment currently in our system built into many of our option schools, anywhere from every 3 weeks mm-hmm. to every 9 to 18. And so just speaking to that ongoing need. And then I will just put in a little bit of a plug, because these are the students that are typically most impacted as well and need support in those families as well. So to have this as an ongoing piece would.
Okay, I'm going to move us. Okay.
So currently our thinking is essentially we move our paper-based process online. In our current paper-based process, you can apply to as many schools as you think fits your students' needs. You're not guaranteed any of those schools except for your neighborhood school. And so that process will not change. What changes is the transparency and the variability in the process. Right now, as a parent, I could apply to 15 schools. I could be on 15 waiting lists. I don't know where I'm going to go in regards to getting confirmation on that. I could have feedback. That school could call me back and say, you have 48 hours, or I could keep calling a school saying, where am I? And I don't know where I am on the waiting list. And the first day of school, I could get a call and say, hey, we have an opening. Would you like to come here? So what we want to do is essentially remove that variability, provide more transparency, and essentially validate our current choice process and the information back to parents in those choices.
feel like we were going to hear back from Rose in mid-May.
We the latest update we got from them is they have moved from their smaller committee, their education committee, to the larger board. So they're having conversations pretty soon here about approval. I can't give you a specific date, but we can follow up with them and ask if they have a date. But I would say before you make a budget decision in June, we'll have an answer for you.
I have one more question. Right, I forgot to ask it.
Here's the mic.
Just focusing, let's say, on elementary schools, that I know in any given year, suddenly they need three more third graders, or, you know, in light of what we've just done, let's say, a bunch of first graders. That communication between the building's needs and their staffing, I recognize that's still a critical point of communication, that continues through this process. We're lifting some of those paper obligations and some of those time consumption and creating consistency, but we aren't eliminating that need for, because that's critical to their budget. So we need three more kindergartners, we need four more this, but I don't need 25 new students. It's really isolated, and that hits kindergartens, I think, in particular, that communication continues through this process or doesn't.
Are you talking about the waitlist part, like their ability to go to the waitlist?
No, just in terms of, so my experience with this is when you are dealing with whether PTA accountability and you're budgeting and you're making decisions, some of it really has to do with your student enrollment, and you have consistent enrollment, but for whatever reason, we need four more third graders in order to make sure that we get that extra FTE, that we get this thing, and that piece really has to do with the autonomy of a building's ability to say, I'm going to take that sibling, I'm going to take this. It may seem unfair, but the reality is it's a necessary piece of this that continues. You understand what I'm talking about. Maybe you can articulate it better.
Yes.
I just want to mention that you're not wrong that that's critical. I'm assuming that in that timeline of conversations moving forward, one conversation you will be having closely connected to school leadership is who's enrolling. You're going to have to be able to identify for principals. Principals, you are still enrolling or approving enrollment, or will each principal be given a number that they hit or a number per grade? That is going to be critical information that you all answer with building leadership, not in isolation.
That's an essential part of this process, is establishing what is the expected enrollment at the school and then using the choice process to help the school hit that enrollment. It's an iterative process because the choices don't always come in exactly like we expect, but you have to keep looking at where the choice enrollment is happening, and to some degree the approval process around which kids are going to which schools helps you balance that as well.
Issue, autonomy that I wanted to address.
Just one of the things that we've been talking about is also building in a pause period to where principals could readjust numbers. And so we would run the lottery, it would work, we'd pause, all principals look at their numbers, see what's in there, readjust, reopen the process in order to do exactly what you're talking about.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. The other hope that we have is to be able to see how many students are on particular wait lists and how many schools they may be waitlisted in. Not which schools, but if we only have three students and they're waitlisted in 10 schools, the likelihood of getting them in our school would be pretty low. And so we're trying to give some of those tools to the principal if we can build it into the system.
Okay, I think this mic is on. I'm gonna try to bring closure to this topic. I have a couple of observations. I'm really glad that we're trying to learn from some of the districts who have gone before us down this path. Let's see if we can avoid some of the problems that come along with it. I'm assuming some plans would be in the works to deal with the language barrier that some of our families may face. I'm going to assume that and move on. And then I would like to ask.
Yes.
Thank you, Dr. Glass. And then I would like to ask, is there any possibility that you think this system would make us less personable as a district? And would our schools actually view this as another big change that's coming down the pike for them? I'd like to just raise that as a question.
Probably yes and yes. It it does have the potential to make this process less personal. However, you still should be encouraging people to visit the schools that they're interested in, creating school interest nights, open house, I mean, all of that stuff that currently is in place to welcome people in and get them to learn about the schools. You should continue all of that and even do more of it and buttress it with all of the marketing efforts that we're coupling with this. So it doesn't have to make the district less personal because I think it can we can refocus our efforts on getting communities into schools and learning about them. This is a big shift to your second question. It is a big shift in how we do business, and it is complicated, and there's a number of steps that have to be executed, but the payoff on the other side, I think you've heard about the benefits or the why behind this. We think that the juice is worth the squeeze, frankly. We think that this is a something that Jeffco Public Schools is ready to engage in, and it'll bring benefits to the community.
Thank you, Dr. Glass. I wish I had thought about that, you know, little picture of juice in the squeeze, and I could have asked the question more carefully, but thank you. I think with that, we need to bring closure to this because we do have one more agenda item. So thank you, Mr. Hsu and team, for the information. I appreciate our community being fully informed on this matter as we think about moving it forward. So thank you for your time today. And that leads us to the next item on our agenda, which is an employee negotiations update. Our employee negotiations team will provide an update on the status of negotiations with district employee associations. For those unaware, under Colorado law, school board discussions regarding employee contracts must be conducted in open session, except under very specific legal circumstances. This session will provide board members with an update on the status of negotiations with JCEA and the Jeffco Education Support Professionals. The board received a report on negotiations on January 25th of 2018. We are now, I think, in the middle of negotiations. I probably should say that we need to be thoughtful and mindful of the fact that we are still in negotiations as we begin this update. Dr. Glass, anything you would like to add?
I think you've said it well. Thank you.
Okay. So I think with us, I see that with us are Ms. Weber and Mr. Jim Branham, our legal counsel. Please give us your thoughts and an update on where we are today.
Thank you. I'm going to actually let Jim kick us off because the very first thing that we want to do, I think, touches on what you had said, Mr. Mitchell, which is what does Prop 104 suggest within the negotiations? So, Jim?
I'll do my best. We'll do my best to cover all the dense information on this slide as quickly as I can. And no offense, Amy, but I chose to sit down here with the attorneys. This is just a quick reminder that, as you know, Prop 104 prohibits us from meeting in executive session to talk about a collective bargaining agreement or to talk about strategy in negotiations or to receive direction from the board to the bargaining team. So that's why we're doing this in public. We will do our best, though, with that background. And as Mr. Mitchell mentioned, we're deep into the negotiations now, but we'll do our best to answer any questions that you've got. And so back to you, Amy.
Thank you.
Is this a point where I can actually say publicly, Prop 104 is probably one of the worst policies that's ever been developed, and I think it's highly unfortunate.
No, you should not say that publicly, Mr. Mitchell.
thanks for the legal advice. I won't say it again.
So moving forward into where we're at with negotiations, so we are in the middle of negotiations with JCA. We have a contract with JCA that runs through 2021. This particular year, we can, our financial items, and each team could bring two additional items. So far, we've had six sessions to date. Most of those are Monday nights here in the boardroom or down in room 4E. You can certainly attend publicly or watch them streamed if you want to watch negotiations. All of the dates are published on our website. So the district brought two items. We brought non-renewal language aligned to state law. That was one of our items. The second item was to look at school level staffing flexibility so that we were aligning the staffing decisions that schools are able to make with the funding decisions that they're making through SBB. Those were our two issues. JCA brought two items. They brought Article 5, which is an article that talks about how schools use time in their buildings, time for planning particularly. They also brought some language in that article around substitute coverage when we do not have sufficient substitutes in the building and teachers have to step in. The second item that JCA brought is Article 8, staffing. So both of the teams brought Article 8 as one of the discussion points, and if any of you have been watching, we've had a couple of robust conversations over a couple different meetings on this topic because it matters to both teams. And as you might guess, in negotiations, we don't always come from the same place when we start those discussions. So what is the status of our work with JCA? So far, the completed items, we've agreed that the non-renewal language that the district brought, we can, in fact, operate aligned with state law. So there has no language change to the master agreement around that particular one. The second thing is we've agreed to a joint task force to consider weekly early release or late starts. This is a common practice that a number of districts across the United States employ as a means to gain planning time for teachers, particularly those teachers who work in the kindergarten to eighth grade, those age ranges. And so that's a common theme, a common activity in many districts across the United States, but here in Jeffco we have not done that. We originally had hoped we might be able to address that through the calendar committee, but the time frame with the calendar committee did not align with that. Both the district team and the JCA team acknowledge that having sufficient time for teachers in the elementary grades to have individual planning time as well as joint collaborative planning time as well as professional learning communities, those are all pressures on their school day, and we appreciate that. And so we have agreed to a joint task force to take a look at that because we also understand the impact in the public when there's an early release or a late start and they have to address their students and how they are taken care of. So we get that, and we're going to have a joint task force. Article 5, we agreed to some language on the individual plan time for teachers. In the previous contract, it had called out a percentage. It calls out the equivalent minutes. So that was, sounds like a lot of go back and forth for not much of a change, but there were some other changes in there, and this was sort of the landing spot for the two teams. We also have agreed to change some language around the coverage for classes when substitute teachers cannot be secured. We want to financially compensate our own teachers when they lose their planning period because they're covering for another teacher, or when students have to be divided out among classes and get covered by a number of people in the building. Jeffco continues to have a very high rate of filled jobs for substitutes compared to some of our neighboring districts, but we do recognize that on occasion we're short. We want to be sure we're compensating our teachers. So the pending non-financial item that we're going to be working on tonight is Article 8. Again, we've talked about it at a couple different meetings. We've exchanged some language that has been quite different, and the intent tonight is to get back to the table with both of the teams and some additional draft language. You'll probably, if you tune in tonight, see us in caucuses quite a bit of the time as we wrestle through the language changes in that article that have been proposed by both sides. So JESPA, the current contract for JESPA goes through August 2019. They can bring financial items, and they've agreed to bring one mutual item on employee evaluations. There's been two JESPA meetings to date, three more are scheduled. There was no point in getting started early when the big ticket item is compensation. They wanted to be sure to wait until there was additional data. I really don't know what we're building. Is that the roof?
We hope.
So the status, Sundeck, yeah. The status is that so far they have agreed to a joint task force around the evaluation rubrics and the processes for JESPA staff. So that was the mutual item that was discussed. And so there'll be that work will happen away from the bargaining table in preparation for any language changes next year. So that's the one piece that has been agreed to with JESPA so far. So the compensation piece, the compensation conversation we're hoping with JCA can start tonight. I'll be presenting some market data that was also presented to the board in the board packets. So you will be talking about that with our JCA team. And we hope to be hearing from the JCA team what their priorities for compensation are. We did have a joint meeting with JESPA and JCA around how we cost share our benefit premiums. That was as a result of a recommendation coming out of the Benefits Advisory Committee that we consider putting additional dollars into what our employees who are covering their children pay for their health insurance. We have a standard rate that every employee receives, which reduces healthcare premiums. It's $529 a month. So if you cover yourself, that goes almost the full distance in covering your healthcare costs. If you cover yourself and your spouse, it goes most of the way, but not all. But if you're covering children, you are kicking in anywhere from $400 to $500, maybe more on the family side to cover individuals. So the Benefits Advisory Committee was interested in getting a proposal in front of the two negotiating teams that said, please consider making that part of your compensation request, that we would cost share those premiums at a higher rate for people covering children. So that would be two categories, employee plus children and families. At this point, two teams indicated that they've said, they want to see what the whole compensation package is, but they do have a focus on employee compensation, not necessarily premium reduction. So this will be one of the items that as we start to talk in more detail about the finances may come back up again. So as you all know, every time we get together to talk dollars, we do have competing demands throughout the district, strategic and program initiative needs, the PARA proposals. I know that the legislators working in some direction around the PARA piece. Competitive compensation is always a concern, rising healthcare costs, facility upkeep and needs. The money spreads only so far, so we recognize that we have all of these competing demands that we have to be considering. And with that, we will turn it over to questions.
Okay, careful questions from the board.
I wanted to lift up a couple of concerns that I've heard while being out and about. One is that the situation is, in some of our schools, they'll schedule a substitute. That's the topic. They'll schedule a substitute, but then the substitute manages to get a better offer, so they never show up. It really leads to some unpredictability in terms of who's teaching a class in a school on a given day. If the teachers can't really reliably do that. I remember at one point, maybe it was 2 years ago, we had a discussion about trade-offs of compensation. Substitutes versus compensating the full-time teachers. And so I guess I want to remind that that's an ongoing challenge for us to get enough substitutes available. Are you hearing that substitute availability is an increasing problem?
We continually watch this. We've had two things that we're concerned about. One thing is that when districts start to pay their daily subs, so don't think yet in terms of people who are coming in to fill in for longer leaves, but just the day-to-day work, there are some districts who start to pay a pretty high differential daily rate after a certain number of jobs have been accepted by the substitutes. And once substitutes start to hit those rates in other districts, we do find that some of them peel off and go take other jobs. We have heard this complaint. We do track on this. If a substitute accepts a job and then they're routinely canceling that job, my team follows up with that substitute to have a conversation around that and change that behavior. I do not believe it happens as frequently as people perceive that it might, but we could certainly get some data and maybe put it in a weekly update that lets you know where we're doing with that rate. My team came forward with two proposals this year, one of which has hit the budget list, but the other one didn't. When I pushed on them to say what was the first priority for where we would put any additional dollars, if there were additional dollars around subs, they said in the long term, the daily rate for long-term subs. So if we have to have someone cover a classroom for a period of time, they're doing all the planning, they're the teacher of record for those students, and we are considerably off the market rates with that those substitutes. And so we have a budget item that's been before the board that addresses that. Would we love to pay more on our daily sub rates? Of course, but we believe in looking at the data that we're at a decent balance given the competing demands for the funds. But I can also send some additional information to your weekly update.
The second is the early release, late start discussion. I think we may have some schools that have initiated that on their own. I have to think that that creates a burden for families. On the other hand, I would raise up that about 2 weeks ago or a month ago, we heard one of our other metro districts actually decided to go to a four-day school year or a four-day school week, which I recently learned is the case in about half the districts in Colorado. I think probably families in Jeffco would be really surprised that half the districts in Colorado are already on a four-day week. That would really impact families.
So we updated the master agreement language last year to allow schools within an articulation area to coordinate either a late start or an early release. The coordination that's required to around transportation and some of those other pieces is not trivial, and I know people get frustrated with that. Why are we letting the buses, you know, drive that? But there's always a cost trade-off. If you want to be less efficient with your buses, then there's money involved. So some articulation areas have moved towards that, but it's been difficult and challenging for our schools to accomplish that, which is why JCA brought a proposal to the table that we consider doing it district-wide.
So I have a question about the long-term sub. Is that in an attempt to address those late cancellations?
No, having more long-term subs that pick up jobs does not handle those
right,
day-to-day subs.
Long-term sub is like 30 or more.
Correct.
In a row.
Correct. They're filling in for teachers who have a long-term absence.
So what do you see in our future when we do have adequate funding? Because we are all advocating for that all the time as an answer to that.
We would love to have a higher daily rate of pay for our substitutes.
That alone would do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, the substitute equation, often when I talk to our substitutes, they operate within a little bit of a radius. You know, what's close to my home? Where did I teach? Because I want to go back and support those teachers, all of those types of things. But we do want to be competitive with our surrounding jurisdictions, and we are not right now with the daily sub rate. We're not off by a lot, but we are off enough that if we had an opportunity to have more money, we would absolutely increase that rate. But I don't think, and I'll get you some data, that we're seeing a bunch of people canceling jobs at the last minute. Because, again, they want to teach where they know the teachers. They want to teach where they know the students.
As Amy mentioned, there is a budget request in the district's proposal around this. So when we have the next budget update with you guys, you'll be able to see that in there, what the cost associated with it is. And you can give us feedback on if that needs to be elevated or lowered down in the prioritization.
For the day-to-day?
Not for the day-to-day, it's for long-term subs.
Long-term subs, I'm sorry.
Subs.
All right, so then, did I hear you right when you said that other school districts, like after so many days, increase the pay?
Yes, we also do the same thing, yeah. Okay. And you may recall, and I think this is what you were referring to, about 3 years ago, we had a pilot project where we counted the number of days someone accepted, and then they received, I don't know what we called it, an additional pay or a bonus, just to try and elevate the number of days they were having. And if they took enough days, instead of making on average $95 or $100 a day, they could make $108 a day because they'd get this additional money. We didn't see that it made a difference in terms of the number of days people picked up. What we were trying to do with that initiative was to change the dynamic and get more of our subs accepting more days. And it didn't really cross that threshold. We have a number of people who pick up a whole bunch of days and a number of people who are more random. It did not change the behavior.
Okay. Then one last question. How are we competitively day-to-day with our surrounding districts?
For the substitute rates? I don't have that sitting here in front of me, so let me send it in a weekly update, because when my team brought forward the proposal, it was both daily rates and long-term subs, and given the budget situation, we prioritized the long-term sub rate over the other one, but I can get it to you for Friday.
Thank you.
Any other questions regarding negotiations process?
Well, we're being pretty careful because we can't really talk about a lot of things, right? So is there anything... Because you're representing both sides here, right? I mean, you're trying to? Or is there anything we ought to know?
I'm trying to be fair in my reporting, and I'll let Jim address the other.
Yeah, I wouldn't use the term representing, because we don't obviously represent JCEA or their position here. But as Amy said, we are trying to be, and Amy is being, very careful to present fairly what's been talked about at the table. But Allie, I would say if you've got a question, ask it, and if we can't answer it, we'll tell you that's going to be hard to answer in public.
Well, I was just wondering more about the Article 8, since it seems, I was wondering if you can give us more information about.
Sure.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. So the district team, our approach to Article 8, and Article 8 is an article that talks about classroom sizes, how we allocate teachers, the types of educators that we use in buildings. There's a couple of pieces where it calls out specific types of educators in buildings and has some requirements on schools as to whether or not they have that type of a resource in their building. The district team took what we will call an aspirational approach to Article 8 in an attempt to line up the master agreement with what we believe is the direction of the district as far as funding given to the school level to make decisions closest to the students around the types of educators they need in their particular school. The contract has a number of places where it talks about collaborative processes that are engaged in at the building with the administrators and the teachers to make those decisions. And so our attempt with Article 8 was to line those pieces up so that there was a little more flexibility at the building level. I will give you an example. Digital teacher librarians are called out in the agreement, and it says if you have a certain number of students, every school will have one, and if you have more than 400 students, it needs to be full-time. We wanted to call out the value and role of digital teacher librarians, but to allow schools the flexibility within their funding and their SBB dollars to make the decisions around the types of educators that they purchased at their school to move students academically. So we came forward with some very aspirational language. The JCA team has a shared goal with the value of these educators and local decision making and some of those other kinds of pieces, but felt that keeping some language that called out the ratios that are in the contract is important to ensure that schools have what I'll kind of call a backstop with the numbers of educators they have in the building and how they're used. So we kind of came at things from a very different perspective, and we have exchanged language a couple times in Article 8, and we're going to come back tonight and try and round down on language that kind of crosses that gap. Did that help?
Yes, that does. And you've said class sizes a couple of times. Are both groups, I don't want to say sides because we're all one team, are both groups committed to keeping class sizes at a minimum?
We have the current master agreement has guidelines. Both sides recognize that those kinds of guidelines are helpful to school communities when they talk about how many educators to have. In our view of an aspirational Article 8 document, the guidelines were not in there, but we anticipated that the guidelines would then in fact be in something like the SBB documents that schools use. So we understand the value of guidelines and calling out class sizes. There has been no talk at the table about changing those guidelines. As you've heard in other years, anytime you reduce those numbers so that the guidelines are tighter, there's a cost to that because it takes more teachers because you've shrunk the number of students in the classes. So we're not talking about changing those guidelines. It was really just a philosophical difference about where those guidelines would reside.
Okay. And then it seems like there's always talk about art, music, and PE, and with the sixth grade transition, I'm wondering if you feel like the collaboration's thick and you're working together to figure that one out. I'm not sure. And if you anticipate us getting any letters in the future, what might they say?
The second one I will not probably be able to answer. Both of the teams are committed to having art, music, and PE. We have taken a very deliberate strategy within the staffing cycle this year to encourage schools to buy up their AMP teachers. We have a very fundamental belief that when you have an educator in one building serving one set of families, that they know the families deeply, they know the students deeply, and to the extent we can deploy those educators to use their skills to help in additional ways in the building that are appropriate for their licensure type and their skill set, that you get a win-win for the school and for the teacher. And so our district team, when we've talked about AMP, we did take a run at taking the sections out of the contract at one of our negotiation sessions, not because we don't believe those guidelines are important, but because we believed we wanted to think about an aspirational document that aligned Article 8 with how we're doing our funding. So our intent on the district side is to encourage schools, whenever possible, to leverage their resources, one teacher, one building, to meet the needs of students to the extent they can, not to work outside of doing AMP or PE or music. Those are critical curriculums. Those are critical goals that we want to accomplish, and we've talked about that at the table. So I think our differences on AMP are pretty narrow. There's been some talk about how we count those sections and determine the numbers of people, but that operates in a pretty narrow slice. The rest of it, we're in agreement on.
Okay. And then my last question would be about the collaboration piece, because it's so important to us to have healthy relationships with all employee groups. And I'd just like your opinion on that.
So I'll talk about that at two levels. I believe at the negotiating table, as always, we have challenging discussions, but I do believe that we come to the table with a shared problem-solving approach. And I know I fundamentally believe open, honest dialogue leads to better solutions, even if there's some pain in getting there. So I think at the negotiations table, I hope my JCA partners would agree with that. The other second level of collaboration is what goes on at the schools, at the school level. And we have a central team, the District Joint JCA Collaborative Committee, which was established through one of our master agreements a couple years ago, and we continue to wrestle with that. And so that's a topic that comes up at the negotiations table as far as how collaboration is working at the building level. And we're continuing to problem solve that, working with Christopher and Karen.
I think there are other questions. Amanda?
No questions, simply an observation, which is I hope that there's collaboration throughout our community, recognizing that you all navigate tough conversations and trade-offs in an environment of ongoing constraints. We appreciate the long history of that, and we appreciate the spirit of collaboration to solve problems that make education work better in our schools for students. I will elevate how very proud I am of this board to take a long view around larger long-term solutions to adequately and equitably funding our schools so that we can dream and achieve things together that right now exist within trade-off conversations. So I'm gonna keep doing that work outside of the negotiation circle to see how we can do more in the future.
Thank you for teasing out on that completed item about the joint task force that, and having sat on the calendar committee, that it's not one area driving this or that. It's the collaborative impact on transportation, families, and education, and that I think that's an important balance to keep in mind, having just spent time with the bus drivers, that each of these things are interrelated, and that those are important considerations across the board. I don't ever want to serve on the calendar committee again. But no, it was a lovely experience. But you really do firsthand see all of those interests playing out from a parent level and a building level. I can't serve on the calendar committee anymore because I'm here. That's what I meant to say.
Okay, I think we are ready to bring closure to this study session agenda item. I would like to say thank you, Ms. Weber, for the update. Mr. Branham, thank you. And thanks for trying to keep me out of trouble. I do appreciate that. Board members, is there anything else before I close this meeting?
Mr. Mitchell, I wanted to alert all of my fellow board members of a conversation I received last Friday. Recall that last Thursday night at our meeting, guess it was a little over a week ago, two Thursdays ago, we voted to approve an agreement whereby we allowed the possibility of a separation from Golden View Classical Academy from Jeffco. And I heard the next day, Friday, from one of the parents there that that they were very surprised that that was even in the works. I think Friday morning, the board at Golden View also took a decision to approve that agreement. And so I just wanted to let you know that it appeared to me from that conversation that the families at Golden View were really largely not aware that this negotiation was going on or that the relationship was so difficult that that they were going to go and be chartered by the state rather than by Jeffco. So I wanted all of us to be aware of that. I had three school visits earlier today, all in charter schools in my area. And so one of the things I'm focusing on is making sure that we have the sort of relationships with our charters that we really ought to have. And so I would encourage all of us to continue to pay attention to that. These are Jeffco schools, they are Jeffco children, and they're Jeffco families, and we want to make sure we give them the support. And I'll say that in all of my school visits, they report that they get the support they need from our district folks, and I'm grateful for that. So I just, that was a FYI for some information I received.
Mr. Rupert, I'm going to say I appreciate the FYI just for our information only. This is a topic that, of course, is not on our agenda and may or may not be, depending on what we decide to do. I would like to say that from my point of view, the responsibility for communicating with the charter school parents lies with the charter school board, and we probably should not discuss this further unless we put it on our agenda. So with that, I am simply going to say that we have concluded our study session, and this meeting is now adjourned at 1:45 p.m. this afternoon.